You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn why scientists are so excited about the upcoming launch, hopefully, of the James Webb Space Telescope. Now let's take a listen to President Biden addressing the nation yesterday on the Omicron COVID-19 surge.
And I want to start by acknowledging how tired, worried, and frustrated I know you are. I know how you're feeling. For many of you, this will be the first or even the second Christmas where you look across the table, be an empty kitchen chair there.
President Biden also had some positive messages about what life looks like for people who are vaccinated and boosted. While info is still coming out about the Omicron variant, it looks like it's definitely more infectious, it seems, than previous variants. We're talking about what we know about Omicron and how to keep yourself and others safe. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about Omicron and safety? Do you have questions about masks, vaccinations, boosters, and tests? Have you changed holiday plans, travel plans, or are you sticking with it, maybe with some extra precautions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee and a founding member of the COVID information website, Dear Pandemic. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the practical level of stuff. And I imagine Dear Pandemic's getting lots of questions along these lines. What are you telling people about travel and get-together safety over the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, we certainly are. You know, when you asked me to be on the show, I was thinking about how I was on last year, this time actually on 1223, and to talk about the same thing, holiday safety. So at first I was feeling a little down, like, oh, there's still the need to talk about this. But I think, you know, the thing that we can keep in mind is that even, you know, with the Omicron variant circulating, is that we have so many more tools this year to reduce risk at gatherings than we did last year. You know, last year we were talking about quarantining for 2 weeks before you gathered, wearing masks, improving ventilation. And those are still things we can use, but this year we have vaccines, we have boosters, and we have, you know, other tools like rapid tests that really can add those layers of protection for gathering. You know, I think if you're planning to get together with other family members that are fully vaccinated and boosted, that's an amazingly great start to a safer gathering. If you can add another layer of just rapid testing. So I know that, you know, people may have trouble finding these right now, or maybe you've stockpiled them like I did leading up into the holidays. But if everyone at the gathering adds a rapid test beforehand, you take it, swab your nose, and wait 15 minutes. And if everyone's negative on that rapid test, that really provides another assurance that no one's sort of asymptomatic, but still, you know, starting to be infectious at the gathering. And if you are, you know, facing the possibility of getting together with families where either they have young kids who aren't yet vaccinated, family members that are immune compromised, or are at risk of severe complications from COVID if they were to get it, I think that's where it becomes even more important to add on those layers in addition of protection. So, you know, we have to think about our risk in these settings on a spectrum, and that our overall goal is to reduce the risk of transmission to our family members. And I think, you know, it's important that we do stay vigilant in trying to do that, because, you know, 2 days ago, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services declared a public health advisory related to the Omicron variant. It's a variant that's highly transmissible, and with, you know, only less than 60% of Wisconsinites being fully vaccinated right now, that's a large proportion of people that are still vulnerable to COVID. And, I think it gives us reason, you know, given the state of our hospital capacity being currently stretched in many areas across the state, to do those steps, to take those steps to make a safe gathering.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Though some people have seen the Omicron variant started in South Africa, it's also popped up in very quickly in other places. So I've also heard variants aren't necessarily identical. So a variant can be like a type of a virus. So I just wonder, could the Omicron, could some various forms of Omicron variant have popped up in different parts of the world, even if there would have been total travel bans?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Still questions, I think, about where Omicron came from, how it started. Dennis wondering if it might have simultaneously sprung up in different parts of the world.
Yeah, you know, we owe a big credit to scientists in South Africa and the surveillance systems that they have in place there, because, you know, it is possible that Omicron was circulating but not detected. And we are very fortunate that the flag was raised by those surveillance systems, right? And in general, you know, as a virus replicates, as it transmits to other people, it has the opportunity to have mutations be acquired. And so, you know, we've had a number of variants, right, leading up to this point, and Omicron honestly won't likely be the last variant that we have to deal with. You know, I think slowing transmission is always a good goal, even once we're vaccinated, because that means that there's less opportunity for these variants and these mutations to take place that could, you know, make it complicated to continue to control this outbreak or this pandemic.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Amanda, I know there's a lot we still don't know or are still working on with Omicron. I made a statement earlier. It looks like it's more infectious than previous variants. Is that right?
I think there's, yeah, a consensus that, you know, I think from December or from the past week, you know, nationally, we've seen a really steep increase in the proportion of viruses that are sequenced, that are Omicron. We are watching in the UK as the epidemic curve and just the number of daily cases is soaring to new levels not seen in previous parts of the pandemic in that area. So there's no question that this is a highly transmissible variant.
How about the severity and how damaging it is? I know that it looks like it's still an open question. What do we know so far?
Yeah, you know, I think we're just less than a month, really, since Omicron became on the radar, right? So we're still watching. And I think there are some indications that it may be less severe. However, I think we're still trying to take in the context in which we're seeing these outbreaks and to understand, are we seeing less severity because there's a large proportion of the population that is either immune or vaccinated? How is this variant going to act in populations that don't have any immune protection, right? And so we're still watching. We're kind of like trying to see what's happening in the UK. I think the important thing to remember is that, you know, even just by law of averages, some proportion of people will still have severe outcomes from Omicron. And so, you know, even a small proportion of a very large number, for instance, the 40% of people in Wisconsin that are not vaccinated yet, could really tax our health, you know, care systems. And we saw that happen with Delta. Just the sheer number of cases resulted in more hospitalizations and deaths and severe disease because proportionally that's what happens.
Talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, founding member of the COVID info website Dear Pandemic, looking at the latest news about the Omicron variant, what we need to do over the holidays. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or your experiences, if you or someone you know has had this new variant, if you work in a healthcare setting, love to hear what you're seeing. 800-642-1234 is the number. Amanda, what do we know about how Omicron is interacting with various levels of vaccination?
Yeah, I mean, so this was a concern because of the number of mutations on the spike protein, which is what the virus uses to enter our cells. There was concern that vaccines were going to be less effective. And some lab studies have shown that with two doses, the level of neutralizing antibodies, which are the antibodies that attach to that spike protein and basically block it from entering our cells, that those the number or the level of those antibodies is decreased. And, you know, on one hand, you know, we have also seen that with a booster dose of both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, that those antibody levels are increased by 25-fold for Pfizer and 37-fold for the Moderna vaccine. So, you know, there is some potential with a booster to offset that decrease in the neutralizing activity of those antibodies, which is great news. The other piece that we're seeing is that other aspects of our immune response, so T cells, which find infected cells and destroy them, which play a huge role in preventing severe disease once you do become infected, that aspect of our immune system really doesn't seem to be as impaired against the Omicron variant, which is really good news, right? This means that getting vaccinated, getting boosted is really going to still have an impact on reducing your risk of getting infected in the first place. We haven't had a situation where we have total immune evasion, where our vaccines are completely ineffective. And then if even if you do get infected, being vaccinated and getting boosted is going to prevent you from having severe disease.
And just to make it simple here, it seemed like with Delta, even if vaccines weren't as effective, the math was still really simple. You were at much higher risk if you were unvaccinated. The more vaccinated you were, the lower your risk. That still seems to be true with Omicron?
It is, especially if you're boosted.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee epidemiologist Amanda Simonek about the Omicron surge. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling after almost 2 years of this pandemic in the U.S.? Healthcare workers in particular love to hear from you. Are you glad to hear that the Biden administration is sending some federal reinforcements to at least a handful of hospitals, including one in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Milwaukee epidemiologist Amanda Simonek about the Omicron variant and the holidays. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Samantha is with us in Knapp. Samantha, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Samantha?
Just wondering your guest's view on empathy fatigue at this point in the pandemic. It kind of feels like we're living in one giant Darwin Award, honestly, and it's very hard to care at a certain point. And I'm sure as a medical professional, she would be experiencing that even more than the rest of us. And how do we cope with that? I'll take my answer off the air.
Samantha, I just want to be clear. Empathy for people who have COVID or different vaccination statuses, what did you have in mind there in particular?
Empathy for the unvaccinated who are getting sick and dying at this point. Just how to keep caring when people continue to let this rage and they could be doing something about it. How do we keep caring?
Samantha, thanks for the call. Amanda, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I hear you. It's 20 months into this pandemic, and I think my colleagues and I at the social media-based science communication campaign that I help operate, Dear Pandemic, what we've really learned is that there's always space for, one conversation to make a difference in, people having questions and getting those questions answered. We welcome people to submit questions to our website, dearpandemic.org. And I think that there's always room to move the needle on vaccination, and it's hard, and I think we have to find those ways that we, if we've been vaccinated and we can get together with other vaccinated people, that we sort of resume some of those social benefits for ourselves that help us rebuild our stamina and help us sort of get rejuvenated, because we still do have, it's a long road. I think it's hard when we don't know how much longer we have to sort of endure all this. And so those feelings of sort of fatigue are real, and I hear you on it.
Samantha, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Devin on the line in Duluth. Devin, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
So just thinking about this Omicron, and it seems on a worldwide reporting outside of Great Britain anyways, that these symptoms seem to be more mild. I'm sure more studies will have to be done and all of that, but initially here it seems to be more mild than Delta, and it seems to spread quite a bit faster. That seems to be true no matter what right now. At what point do we just say, just pull the Band-Aid off and just let it happen? And I understand that the idea, especially in the beginning, was to flatten the curve, prevent an overload on the hospital system. But what exactly needs to happen with severe illness in the hospital setting? Does going to the hospital actually make sense? Is there a way to have in-home care if they're just on fluids? When numbers start coming out of how many deaths of despair, how many people are dying because they're not going to the hospital, you know, over in Africa, they talked about there was potentially an extra 60,000 people that died of malaria because they didn't go get seek treatment because of COVID. I feel like we're just prolonging this and long-term making this worse. Vaccinated or unvaccinated, seems like vaccinations actually aren't slowing this down. You look at Israel, Canada, Gibraltar, high vaccination rates, huge reinfection rates as time has borne on. Is there a different way that we can just approach this?
Amanda, thanks for the call. So first of all, his idea of pull the Band-Aid off and I guess just let everybody get infected with Omicron.
I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is that our healthcare professionals that are in hospitals right now really struggling to provide care, to have space for patients, not just COVID patients, but because of how taxed our healthcare facilities are right now and our healthcare staff is right now, you know, we're not providing some preventive care and other services for other health conditions, right? So I don't think any healthcare worker today would say, yes, let's just rip the Band-Aid off because they're already really struggling. And so I don't think that's a tenable solution. And we know that even with a variant, you know, if it is less severe, like I said, a small proportion of a very large number still makes a large number of people that end up with severe disease and hospitalization. So, you know, I think we really would run the risk of just completely having a collapse of our healthcare system if we were to do that right now, and that's not a tenable solution.
And Devin also mentioned reinfections, I think hinting that maybe that meant that vaccinations weren't all that effective. What are you watching for when you look at reinfection or so-called breakthrough cases and vaccines?
Yeah. I mean, certainly breakthrough infections are happening in those that have received two doses and even those that have been boosted. You know, we hear a lot in the news, those high profile celebrity people and other politicians that get breakthrough cases. You know, we're not hearing all the same news stories about all the people that aren't having breakthrough cases, right? And, you know, the larger the proportion of the population that's vaccinated, the less people there are that are just susceptible to becoming infected. And so that is still a goal, you know, still increasing vaccination is a goal. And, you know, and certainly we've seen that with the boosters, we get some improved immune protection against even this Omicron variant. And so everyone who is 16 and older is current, and it's been more than 6 months since they got the Pfizer vaccine, can go get boosted. Anyone who's 18 and older and it's been more than 6 months can get either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine. And that is, you know, what's recommended, that people should go get it right now. It's no longer that you may or, you know, you could consider it, but it's highly recommended to go get it. And so I encourage, you know, our uptake of boosters is still quite low nationally and in the state of Wisconsin. So get your first dose, your second dose, and then if you're already been vaccinated and it's been more than 6 months and you're eligible, get your booster dose. That's our best bet right now for easing this surge in the next, you know, coming 6 to 8 weeks that we're currently facing likely because of Omicron.
Talking to Amanda Simonek, UW-Milwaukee epidemiologist, about the latest on COVID-19 and the Omicron variant. A couple points I want to get to before we run out of time. Amanda, I've seen people making the case like, hey, if you're still wearing cloth masks, it's time to up your mask game when you're in public places, especially with lots of other humans. So what are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. So this week, one of my dear pandemic colleagues made a sort of, you know, cheeky post like, hey, weren't we cute in May 2020 in our cloth masks? Because we had a post back then of a picture of about 10 of us wearing our cloth masks. And, you know, the fact is, that was necessary a year and a half ago. We didn't have enough protective equipment for our healthcare staff. We didn't have the ability to go online and order a high filtration mask, but that's not the case now. And so, you know, the recommendation recommendation, especially with highly transmissible variant, is that you do improve your mask. So if you go to dearpandemic.org, you can see, you can search our post, you can type in masks. And a couple of days ago, we had a post up that has a bunch of links to very highly recommended mask sites where you can order masks. You know, if that is cost prohibitive for you, another good option for improving both fit and filtration, which is really what you want to maximize with a face mask, is to just take a surgical mask that you can pretty much get a box of in any pharmacy now, and then wear a cloth mask over that. So in that way, you get the filtration power of a surgical mask, but you get a snugger fit against your face by having the cloth mask worn over it. And those are, you know, what you want. You want fit and filtration, because masks do two things. They keep your germs with you. If you have a tightly fitting mask, you're not expelling your, potential, the virus before you realize you have it when you're out at the grocery store or, you know, in other public places. And then a well-fitting high filtration mask will protect you from breathing in the air around you where the virus might have been expelled. And, you know, really stopping that source control, stopping you and other people, stopping themselves from expelling the virus into the air, is what makes, you know, masks highly effective, is if we all do that in public spaces, there's less virus just floating around to be inhaled.
And just our last half minute, we see a federal approval of a Pfizer viral treatment pill for COVID-19 should hit the streets in a month or two, I think. Are you hopeful that there are going to be that and more tools in the months to come?
I am hopeful. You know, any new development, whether it's a treatment, whether it's, a way that we can test more quickly, identify cases, those are always moments of hope. And so, yes, in addition to wanting people to get vaccinated to prevent getting infected or developing severe disease in the first place, new options for treatments that, should you be infected, help improve the outcomes of those individuals, that's always good news too.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee and a founding member of the COVID information website called Dear Pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Colin Kaepernick started a wave of athletes making public protests over issues of race in the United States and around the world. Join the conversation about the impact of those protests, what they mean today, with the author of a new book called The Kaepernick Effect. Again, you can check out the conversation about protests at athletic events. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Picture the scene. You're at a holiday gathering in person or online, and you want a topic of conversation, maybe something that makes you sound smart. I hope the Ideas Network has you covered, but if you need something else, UW-Madison reached out to experts in different fields for some smart conversational tidbits and factoids. Here are a few responses. James Krall in the entomology department. There are 20,000 species of bees on the planet, just about twice the number of bird species, and individual bees have personalities. Some prefer to do specific tasks in the colony or stay in their own particular corner of the nest in many ways, just like us. Chloe Grace Hart in the sociology department says, our current gender norms are so familiar to us, it's hard to imagine them any other way. If you look across cultures or over time, what's perceived as feminine or masculine turns out to be fluid. For example, people today think of high heels as a symbol of femininity. Go back several centuries, high heels were considered very masculine, a shoe for warriors. Check out lots more at the UW-Madison website. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the creator of a history project to discover stories of past and present indigenous UW students, employees, and faculty. Now, NASA is set to launch the James Webb Space Telescope on Christmas morning after decades of development and years of being pushed back. Scientists say the $10 billion telescope could help them see the origins of the solar system and try to detect life on other planets. Learning more now about how the technology works and why the scientific community is excited and nervous about its launch. Andrew Nine is a graduate student in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Astronomy studying binary stars. His research will use the James Webb Space Telescope if it works as intended. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why are scientists like you so excited about this new telescope?
Well, put short, it is an absolute game changer in astronomy. This is very much the successor telescope to the Hubble Space Telescope, which has produced truly top quality science for at least the past 30 years.
And I've heard people talk about Hubble as like there was astronomy before Hubble, and then there's astronomy after Hubble. It's like a dividing point. Do you think it could be the same with the Webb Telescope?
For sure. Yes, absolutely.
So what is it doing? What can it do? What are its capabilities that are going to be such game changers?
Yeah, so the real special point about James Webb is that it is specialized to look at infrared light. And the reason that is special is it will allow us to see further back in space and in time than ever before. And it will also allow us to study exoplanets in even greater detail.
Now, this is a lot of billions of dollars put into it, a lot of years mm-hmm. put into it. I imagine a lot of people are going to be biting their nails when the launch time comes. Are you going to be watching in real time, or are you just going to go away for a while and hope for the best?
Seeing as it's going to launch early in the morning, I'm going to be in the camp of I will wake up and hope to God.
Yeah. Talk about the complexity of, first of all, this incredibly delicate instrument and the challenges of getting it from Earth into orbit.
Yeah. So, as of right now, the major limiting factor is the weather in French Guiana. So unfortunately, we are currently in the rainy season in Kourou, where the telescope will be launched. So as of right now, the delays that we're experiencing are weather related. Of course, you can't launch a rocket in lightning or in high winds. And then once you get into space, that's by no means the end of the journey. There are over 300 single points of failure on James Webb, which means there are more than 300 components or processes that if any one of them were to fail, the whole mission is gone.
Talking to Andrew Nine from the UW Astronomy Department, looking at the likely launch now on Saturday of the new James Webb Orbital Telescope, what it could mean for science. Andrew, we know this thing will help us see a long way away. And one of the weird things about space is that helps us see into the past. Can you tell us in a way that I can understand why we get to look into the past when we look a long way away?
Yes. So the reason we look into the past when we look into deep space is because light travels at a finite speed. So because it takes light some amount of time to get from the source that emits it, whether it's a star or a galaxy, to here on Earth, because that light travels at some speed, we're seeing that object not as it is right now, but as it was when it sent off that light in the first place. So when we say something is 1 billion light years away, what we're really saying is we are seeing the light now that it emitted 1 billion years ago.
You study binary stars. First of all, give us a binary star 101. How common are they? What are they?
Yes. So a binary star is two stars that orbit one another. They formed at the same time from the same material. So they're identical in composition and they orbit each other for their lifetimes. As for their frequency, there's an old joke that gets passed around in astronomy that goes that three out of every two stars are binaries. Yeah, so for stars like our sun, it turns out that about half of stars like our sun are in binary. So when we see what we think is one star, there are actually two. For lower mass stars, about a tenth of a solar mass or so, their binary frequency is more like 10 or 20%. And for the very highest mass stars, once you get past 10 solar masses or so, all of them are in binaries, as far as we can tell.
So with Webb in place, what are you hoping to learn about binary stars in particular?
Yes, so I work on a particular kind of binary star called a blue straggler. So these are binary stars that are particularly close together, and one star is a little bit more massive than the other, and the star that's more massive will evolve first and expand. And if it's close enough to its companion, the outer layers of that evolved star will get ripped off and dumped onto the companion. So what you end up with is a star that is way bluer, way hotter than it should be given its age. And you'll have a white dwarf that was the core of the former evolved star orbiting it. Now, what we don't know about this process, and what I hope that James Webb will tell us eventually, is whether or not any mass is lost from the system entirely. That's still one of the great big open questions about this process. So what I'm hoping to see is, is there material that is leaving this system that has cooled off and is now emitting in the infrared?
Okay, if I'm an astronomer and I want to get some screen time on the Webb telescope, mm-hmm. I imagine there's a pretty long line. How does that work?
Yes, so in order to get time on the James Webb Space Telescope or on any telescope, you have to submit what is called a proposal. And this is essentially a document that proves you know what the telescope is capable of and you are going to make good use of this time. And of course, there is indeed, as you say, a very long line to use James Webb Space Telescope. There's only so much time available for observing, and the current proposals right now are accounting for approximately 10 times what James Webb is available to give.
So do you have a thought, like if it goes up, how long will it be? Can you get them to point it at some of your favorite binary stars?
I sure hope so, but that is many years down the line for me.
Well, I guess the good news is this is going to free up all kinds of time on the Hubble, right?
Yes, yes. Now, they're going to be answering different kinds of questions, but yeah, hopefully it does free up some time on Hubble as well.
So apart from binary star questions, mm-hmm. what are some of the other things that you're hoping with the Webb telescope in place, the big questions in astronomy that this is going to help us answer?
Yes, so this is going to be the best instrument we have to determine whether or not we are truly alone in the universe. So one of the weird things that James Webb Space Telescope would likely be able to detect is plant life. So it turns out that, yes, now we're not going to resolve any exo-Amazon, as cool as that would be, but it turns out that chlorophyll, the compound that makes plants green and allows them to convert carbon dioxide to oxygen, also reflects really strongly in the infrared. So if we're looking at an exoplanet in the infrared and we see way more infrared light than we should for this exoplanet, that might be an indication there are plants on that planet that use chlorophyll.
That's exciting. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Nine is a graduate student researching binary stars at the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. He's with us today previewing the upcoming launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, latest bump back to Saturday morning. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how watching your parents dance as a child shapes the legacy you leave behind with your own children.
Have you ever been at a wedding and caught a glimpse of your parents slow dancing? Maybe you marveled, or maybe you cringed, but I'm willing to bet you felt something. Jan Larson shares a story about how watching her parents dance in the kitchen brought her comfort as a child, and now as a mother as she watches her children forge their own affections.
The legacy parents leave their children isn't always easy to spot. On those rare occasions when we get a glimpse of something good, it is oh so sweet. As a child, I delighted in my father's nightly ritual. He would sneak up on my mother as they cleared away the dinner table or wiped down the countertops, and what was our kitchen transformed into their private ballroom dance floor. I only have eyes for you. He crooned tenderly as he wrapped his arms around her, his face nestled into that space along the back of her neck and shoulder. Gently, he twirled her around, ignoring her mock protests, and swept her into his arms in a glide across the linoleum floor. The moment was brief, enchanting, and one that left a young child certain of her parents' love. All was right with the world. Some years later, I met and married my own darling. And then, one night while tidying the kitchen, I felt his arms wrap around me, hands turning me to face him as he guided me in our own dance across the hardwood floor. Happy tears pricked at my eyes as he twirled me, pulled me close, and then finished with the big dip. As toddlers, our children squealed with pleasure at Daddy's strength and the light in Mom's eyes. As teens, they offered eye rolls, shoulder shrugs, and the predictable, get a room, to which we replied, we have a license, marriage that is, to do this. But underneath the playful teasing, our children too were certain of their parents' love. And again, all was right with the world. Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, our eldest son stopped in for a Saturday brunch. As logs crackled in the fireplace and music filled our home, I busied myself in the kitchen. The little boy who once reached up to me, now a young man, put his hands on my shoulders and turned me to face him, pulling me toward him for his own dance. As we swayed to the music, he looked down. "I want to be like you," he said. Stunned, my response was brutally honest. "Why?" He tossed his head back in a brief laugh. "Just do." All my mistakes, all my flaws flashed through my mind. This would not do. I did not want to waste the moment. But what to say? "Take the good, but leave the rest," I fairly pleaded. Another light laugh. "Okay, Mom." I realize now I don't need to fear for my son. He knows my flaws, yet finds reason to love. Perhaps in following his father's example, taking our dance and making it his own, he already has claimed the best we have to offer. If the legacy of children being certain of love is what we leave behind, then sweet is the knowledge that all will be right with the world.
Jan Larson is a journalist and professor at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we learn about an effort to collect Native voices and stories to tell a part of the missing history at UW-Madison. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new project at UW-Madison aims to fill in missing stories of Indigenous students and others who are part of the past and present of the campus community. Storytelling is central for our next guest and her family. That tradition is part of what inspired her to seek out unrecorded stories of Native people who've worked for or attended UW. Zeta Ballou is a graduate student at UW-Madison in the History Department and a researcher for the university's Public History Project. Zeta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Miigwech, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you share some of your own experience with storytelling and in your family? You wrote about that some in an online post for the Public History Project.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am an enrolled citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians on my dad's side. And one of my fondest memories growing up as part of this tribal nation is anytime there was a family gathering in my grandmother's house, my dad, my sister, his 11 brothers and siblings would pack into my grandma's house, which in hindsight could probably only comfortably hold less than half of us, but we made it work. And immediately as we got there, we would begin doing what we do best, which is telling and sharing stories, some that we've heard before, many that we haven't. But I brought that love of storytelling and listening with me to graduate school at UW-Madison.
And then you got linked up with this Public History Project. What attracted you to this?
Yeah, so I was hired in the spring of 2021 by the UW-Madison Public History Project, which is a multi-year effort to uncover and give voice to those who experienced, challenged, and overcame prejudice on campus. The goal of the project is to ensure that all students and alumni are aware of the full history of the university, including the accomplishments of campus community members from marginalized populations whose stories previously may have been hidden or not as widely known. So I was hired this past spring to research the Native history of UW-Madison from its founding in 1848 up into the present. As someone who is a Native student at UW herself, myself, I jumped at the opportunity to learn about this history of the university and its Native stories and students on campus.
So you started to hit the archives, and what did you find? And I guess maybe more importantly, what didn't you find?
Yeah, so I started where document-based historians usually start, with the documents. And I went to the Wisconsin Historical Society. I went to the UW archives, and to my great surprise, I could not find Native stories or voices represented in our documents or in our archives more broadly.
Does that mean they weren't there, or that people didn't record those stories?
So I'm leaning more towards the fact that people didn't record those histories because we know that UW-Madison mm-hmm. occupies Ho-Chunk lands. We know that Native people have been here since long before the university and have continued to be here since. And I think that the silences in our archives as they revolve around Native voices is mostly because perhaps the information that gets stored in our archives most often reflects the values of the communities who have contributed to these archives. So since there are so few Native voices and stories in those archives, it sends us a message that, at least in the past, the history of UW's Native students was not as significant as non-Native UW students, alumni, faculty, and staff's histories, or those who have been more fully preserved in our archives.
Talking to Zeta Ballou, graduate student at the UW-Madison History Department, researcher for the university's Public History Project. Zeta, you found that archival absence, and you set out to fix it. What did you do?
Yes, so I went to Native students, faculty, and alumni who I knew, and I started asking the questions, the types of questions that I wish the sources in our archives would have been asking all along. And so I changed my approach completely to this work. I set out to see if those Native students, those activists who had profoundly changed the university, would be willing to share those stories with us. And much to my surprise and pleasure, several of them have since.
What are some of the kinds of stories you're hearing?
Oh gosh, I've met an activist, a revolutionary really, from the 1970s who organized as part of the American Indian Movement and who organized on campus to protest the unjust treatment of Indigenous, Black, and Hispanic students, as well as the Vietnam War during the 1970s. I also met an individual by the name of Kelly Holmes, who during her time as co-president of Wang Sheik, was one of the first on campus to adopt a land acknowledgement or a recognition that their gatherings were taking place on Ho-Chunk land before the widespread acknowledgement or implementation of land acknowledgements across the campus. Those are just two of the several incredible Native people who I've met and I continue to meet each and every day that I'm a part of this project.
And are you finding as you talk to this person, they're saying, oh, and you also ought to talk to blank and blank?
Yes, as soon as I get in touch with one, they introduce me to, I literally have a list of hundreds of Native people who have attended UW and have profoundly shaped this university's history, none of whom I found documented in our archives prior to doing the work of oral history.
Is it weird for people to talk about themselves as being a part of history, if that makes sense? Like, yeah, this is just our daily lives. I don't think we often think of ourselves as being historically significant.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I approach Native folks to do this work, most of the time they're very surprised that anything that they would have to say or the histories that they have about this university would be of any historic value. But in fact, what this project teaches us, not only Native people who have been to UW, but non-Native community members as well, is that anyone, especially Native people at UW, can in fact make history. But this will only happen if their stories are told and preserved for future generations to listen to and learn from.
Yeah, can you talk about the value of oral history in general and any topic, the importance of hearing those stories and like you said, preserving them?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best parts about oral history is that with the collection of these stories, you can now, anyone in the UW community can go to the UW archives, ask to hear a story from Kelly Holmes or other Native students who have gone before here. And you can put on a set of headphones or read the transcript and hear Native people tell stories of this place in their own words and on their own terms. It's absolutely powerful. I highly encourage anyone out there to go into the archives and look for these stories themselves, because you'll learn a significant amount of the past that we don't have documented in our archives besides these oral histories.
This is a UW-Madison specific project, Zeta, but if somebody's listening and saying, we need to do this in my campus or school or community or whatever institution, what would you mm-hmm. recommend them to them to get it started?
Yeah, so I would recommend, number one, starting relationships with the people whose histories you want to have preserved. And with the UW-Madison Public History Project, we have a subscription to a platform called Their Story. It's like Zoom, but it's entirely set up for oral history. So I highly recommend working with that platform because it's been incredibly valuable to us.
What are you looking forward to now? I mean, you've been collecting stories already. What are your plans for the future now on this project?
I would love to collect as many stories as we can. Of course, these things take time and effort and energy. But for those out there listening who want to learn more about these efforts, we are currently, we have a website called the UW-Madison and Public History Projects. If you out there think that you have a story of UW-Madison worth sharing, we are absolutely willing to listen. Reach out to us via our website. And then the next step for the project overall is that in the fall of 2022, there's going to be two exhibits for the UW-Madison and Greater Madison community. There's going to be a physical exhibit housed at the Chazen Museum of Art. That's in the fall of 2022. There you can learn more about the histories of not only Native folks on campus, but other BIPOC students who organized on campus and shaped our community's history. If you can't make it to the physical exhibit, don't worry. We also have a digital exhibit coming up that will be preparing in the fall of 2022 that will be housed on our website.
Zeta, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's UW history grad student Zeta Ballou. She talked with us about her work tracking down and recording stories of Native and Indigenous UW students, staff, and faculty as part of the university's public history project. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, most road crashes are blamed on human error, but a traffic expert says we could change our roads and our systems to prevent a lot of the worst collisions. And from farms to food companies, there's a lot of consolidation in American agriculture. Is bigger better? That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden says he's still hopeful to reach a deal with Senator Joe Manchin on his Build Back Better legislation or something like it. We'll get the latest during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.